Rio de Janeiro
with a big man.
G'day, Kaya, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Rio de Janeiro. My name is Abid Imam, and this show is all about engaging conversations with inspirational personalities and public figures to help us understand people, culture, and the world. On this edition, we are joined by Samantha Lewis. Samantha is a digital sports journalist at the ABC who specializes in Australian women's football and women's football more broadly, covering all the aspects of the sport from grassroots to international level, including Olympic Games and World Cups. There's a particular love of history, profiles, and long-form feature writing. Samantha's work has been published by The Guardian, ESPN, Optus Sport, and SBS The World Game. Gadigal land is where Samantha lives and works. Samantha is one of my favourite football writers on the planet, covering topics that cut to the core of Australian and world football, doing so in such a creative and emotive way. It certainly captures the feeling of a moment, and I've really, really enjoyed reading the articles. I invited Sam to the show before the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup, but because of our schedules, we actually couldn't make it happen. This was actually a blessing in disguise because we were both able to use this conversation to decompress from the World Cup. For both of us, we had that hindsight of time, and it was, in a way, quite healing and cathartic to revisit the emotions. Samantha produced some incredible work during the tournament, so it's wonderful to go back again and have the hindsight of time to reflect. I hope it helps you recount some of the great World Cup memories as well and gives you a further appreciation for the work behind the scenes. In crafting those words that you read in an article from great journalists like Samantha. Thank you immensely to Samantha for being so candid and open in this conversation. This show itself couldn't be where it is without your support, so please give a review or subscribe to help support Rio de Janeiro storytelling. Enjoy this conversation with Samantha Lewis, one of the great football writers and advocates of the game. Samantha Lewis, welcome to the Rio de Janeiro podcast. I'm really excited that you could join me because, you know, for quite a while as a football fan, I've been reading your articles and seeing your journalism across ABC and other platforms. And I got to say, like, it's amazing. And I'm a big fan of the way you paint the picture for the fans and bring some really emotive qualities and the poetry in your work. So a big thank you for also during the FIFA Women's World Cup. I was working behind the scenes, but your articles almost helped me to get through some of those tough stages where the Matildas went out and the like. So I really can't wait to delve into that. But thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Wow, what an intro. I'm thrilled that anyone reads my work, really. It still surprises me that this stuff that I type into my computer and send it off into the ether actually like hits people and all of a sudden they're kind of moved by it. That's such a thrill to me.
That's so cool. And I'd love to start with your love for football and maybe those early days. You know, what are some of those first memories growing up?
Yeah, look, I was football was not really a huge part of my like early childhood. I came from a very multi-sport family, so I played pretty much every sport under the sun. My dad was a big cricketer. My mum really loved hockey and swimming, so I tried all of those out. But when I started to get a little bit older, the two sports that I really gravitated towards were football and basketball because I was quite tall for my age and so was able to sort of use that to my advantage up until the point where I was about 15 and all of a sudden all the women around me were getting growth spurts and I was the shortest person in the team. So when it got to a stage where I had to basically choose which sport I wanted to pursue because pursuing both was too expensive, I chose football because one of the most important and formative memories of mine is watching the Socceroos qualify for the 2006 World Cup after defeating Uruguay. I have such a vivid recollection of exactly where I was in my mother's house watching that game. I was allowed to stay up beyond my bedtime to watch it. I went to the penalty shootout. I remember like the sound of the ball thwacking against Mark Schwartz's gloves. You know, I remember John Aloisi's penalty. I remember the sound of my entire neighborhood like exploding because it turned out we were all actually watching this one moment together. And that was the first time that I realized that football was not just this thing that I played with my friends on a Sunday. It was this big collective community experience that was able to transcend a lot of the barriers that it felt like we had in the world. So that moment has stuck with me forever. And the fact that I have been able to now go sort of full circle and be part of a moment like that with the Matildas and the Women's World Cup last year, it still blows my mind to even think about.
How did that moment in 2005 translate to you maybe kicking a ball or getting involved in the real life of football?
Yeah, well, I was still, like, I was playing it at that point, but I don't think I did, I took it very seriously. I think it was just like a bit of a thing, largely that my mum was doing to get me out of the house because I was very annoying. but I really loved football. And when I started to get older and I started to really understand it and I started to watch it more, I loved so much that it felt like a very, it was felt like a thinking game. It felt like a tactical game. It was a strategic game. You know, you could have a group of players who maybe weren't the fastest or the fittest or the tallest, but they could be the smartest and that would be able to win the game. And I loved that so much as a little bit of a brainiac myself. So, yeah, and I loved that it was outside. I loved that all my friends were part of it. And I loved that I felt very safe when I was playing it as well. That was something that I really cherished from a young age, I think, particularly being involved in women's teams and the environment that was created in women's teams when I was growing up. I felt very safe and very accepted in those spaces, and they allowed me to explore parts of myself and to learn about who I was, and I'll be forever grateful for that as well.
Were there any players you were, or clubs even, that you were gravitating to, watching, any heroes, idols?
Oh, so when I was in my late teens, I started to pay a lot more attention to the NPL, and my local NPL women's team was the Macarthur Rams. And so after my Sunday games would finish, which would be around, I don't know, 3 o'clock, I would race home, quickly scoff down some toast and drive out to Lynwood Park, which was about a 15-minute drive from my house, where the Macarthur Rams women's team would be playing in the afternoons. And I have so many really fond memories of being one of the only people really in the grandstand, along with maybe a scattering of family and friends or some Macarthur Rams youth players and a couple of kookaburras, sitting there and watching these extraordinary women playing football. And it wasn't until sort of a couple of years later where I was learning more about the Matildas. I was trying to do more research online, figure out, you know, what the history of this game really was, that I learned that some of these players I were watching were actually Matildas. There was Teresa Polias and Kylie Ledbrook and Lena Karmas and Renee Rollison and all these players who didn't really get any spotlight on them when it was their heyday as part of the national team. And they were just here in front of me, like 10 metres away, playing extraordinary football in front of absolutely nobody. And as I was getting older and sort of coming to consciousness of myself as a woman in the world and feminism and all that kind of stuff, I was increasingly frustrated that these amazing athletes were here doing this incredible thing and that nobody seemed to care about it. So that was kind of the start, I suppose, of my bigger journey into football journalism, was going to these games and being so in awe of what these women were doing, but also so infuriated that nobody was paying attention to them.
With the live tweeting and the coverage you're providing these fantastic players, how are they responding to having this coverage now?
I have no idea. I don't know if they ever read them. I have no idea if anyone ever told them that I was doing that. They probably just spied like a weird woman up in the back of the grandstand at Lynwood Park, like staring into her phone and taking videos and things like that. I have no idea. I've never asked them. That's actually a really great point. Maybe I should send Teresa Polias a text message and say, hey, remember like 10 years ago when you were still at the Rams? And yeah, I don't know, see what she can remember. But I don't know. I hope that they read it. I hope that they saw that there was someone out there who really cared. I know that the players were frustrated that their games weren't being covered by the local newspaper, for example, even though they were, you know, consecutive champions in the NPLW for a time. There was a MacArthur Rams women's Twitter account even, which was... It hadn't been used in years, and I remember spending a good 6 months trying to track down whoever owned the Twitter account. I'd go to the clubhouse and ask all the managers and all this kind of stuff, and eventually one conversation led to another conversation with another person and blah, 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 and I ended up finding the woman who started the Rams women's account, but she didn't tweet from it anymore because she moved away. And I asked her, well, can I do it? Because I'm going to these games anyway. Can I use the Twitter account that you've already created? And she was like, sure. So I ended up actually tweeting from the MacArthur Rams women's account after tweeting just from my own account for a little while. So that was a small win in the grand scheme of things. But for me, it felt like a really huge deal at the time.
You know, from MacArthur Rams at Lynwood Park to the dazzling stadiums of France Women's World Cup 2019. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce those stadiums in France because my French isn't great, but I'm a big fan of sliding doors moments. And you talked about that being a real sliding doors for you. And the view from the cheap seats was one of your initiatives. Yeah. How do you reflect on that time and being able to go see the Matildas at a World Cup for the first time?
Oh, it was amazing. It was so amazing. I remember watching the 2015 Women's World Cup on television and being so jealous of the Australians that I knew who'd travelled there. But at that time, in 2015, when I was watching that and I was, you know, going along to W League games and starting to get much more involved in things, football journalism was never something that was on my horizon. It was never something that I considered that I could do. And I think that was largely in part because I just didn't see it anywhere. I didn't see women being football journalists. I didn't see journalists writing about women's football. It just wasn't part of my imaginative possibilities. And so when it came time to figure out, you know, my university studies after I graduated high school, the thing that I loved doing most was writing. So I jumped from a couple of different degrees and eventually landed in English literature, and I stayed at uni for about 10 years, getting all the way to halfway through a PhD, actually, with every intention of becoming an academic. But then 2019 came around, and at that point, you know, I'd been writing voluntarily for a website called The Women's Game for a little while, which had then turned into Beyond 90, which it's still called today. I was covering NPLW. I'd written match reports for Football New South Wales. So I'd been doing a little bit here and there. And then the Women's World Cup rolled around and a group of friends and I decided that we would go just for a holiday, just to go and have fun. We'd all never been to a Women's World Cup before. Some of us hadn't. And this seemed like the perfect opportunity to do it because we loved the Matildas and we had enough money to do it as well. And we had the time. So we were like, the hell, let's go. Let's go and see what this is all about. So I remember, I think it was 2 weeks before I left, Optus Sport had just started up here in Australia and they were broadcasting the tournament back here. And they tweeted something like, folks, we're looking for contributions to our website to sort of sync up with our Women's World Cup coverage. Do you have any ideas? And I was like, well, I'm going to the tournament that you're broadcasting, so yeah. Why don't I write like a travel column about what it's like to follow your national team overseas? And they replied to me and they said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. So I was like, oh, crap. Okay, now I have to actually do it. Oh, no. So I went to France and I wrote this series of stories called The View from the Cheap Seats, as you said, which was this really weird kind of combination of all of my creative writing skills with travel writing and sports analysis and all the kind of stuff that I now, in hindsight, realize I have always really loved to do. And I think I've kind of returned back to that type of writing in recent years as well. And I just wrote about the sort of the emotional experience of following the Matildas through France and the ups and downs that we experienced there. And It was incredibly rewarding to do that as well, to be able to use writing to not just capture what we were experiencing on the ground for people back here in Australia who maybe were only just being able to see the games, but also being able to use writing to kind of process the emotions that we were going through as well, especially in that final game where we got knocked out in Nice against Norway. That was a really traumatic period for a lot of us. And so I was really grateful for the opportunity that Optus gave me. And you know, when I got back, I was able to keep writing for them in a freelance capacity for a couple of years. So they were, I'm going to be forever grateful to David Weiner in particular for saying yes to my crazy idea when he put that tweet out.
So when you're overseas and you're in a World Cup and you're enjoying the intoxication of the atmosphere and how amazing it is to be there, but you're also needing to deliver in terms of your art and your craft and having that time, how do you even balance that? How did you sort of navigate creating space to be creative?
Yeah, great question. I think at that point, because I hadn't worked in journalism in any formal sense, I didn't really understand what a deadline was. Like I'd done it in academia and I sort of understood it in that sort of bigger sense, but I didn't really comprehend or appreciate the fact that a piece of writing needed to be done by X time and you only had like a day to write it, especially taking time zones into consideration as well, you know, wanting to have a story up the next morning, say, in Australia, which meant that you only had 7 hours to put something together. I think I at that point, because I was still so excited by the whole thing, it didn't really stress me. Because I would just want to write about it anyway. You know, I was going through all this amazing stuff and I was taking notes all the time and I was like, how cool is this? I'm writing, you know, I'm getting paid to write about following the Matildas for Optus and all these people are reading and isn't that amazing? So the time pressure or the time constraints never really pressed themselves upon me in that way. It certainly did as I started to freelance in a more serious capacity and I would have to do stories on the whistle and file things, you know, an hour after a game, things like that. At the point at which I realized that I actually hate those kinds of stories. I'd hate deadlines. I'm not very good at them. I don't like the pressure that kind of thing places on me because I get too stressed out by it and I can just feel the time ticking away and I'm not doing anything. So it's just, don't like it. But, it was a really, when we were in France, I think because I was so, I was still such a fan. And I was still so enjoying the moment and the experience and being with my friends and being in a new country and learning all these new things that I was kind of just a funnel for language. And I just like, I absorbed all this stuff and it just sort of spilled out onto the page. And, you know, I think one of the stories ended up at like 2,500 words or something, wow. You know, kind of crazy. So yeah, like it's, but that's kind of what happens when you're a writer, I suppose, like you just get in the flow and you disappear into it and you end up with something at the end that all of a sudden the editor now has to deal with because you've done your job.
Are you taking notes with a notepad traditionally or are you very much like using other forms of technology?
Usually it's in my phone. Usually I have a notes app in my phone and I type away at that. Sometimes I do voice notes to myself as well. If I'm like in a particular space where there are lots of lots of noise or lots of colours or like it's a very sort of vivid experience, I usually use a voice note to try and capture the atmosphere of that as well. Sometimes I would just have to scribble on literally any piece of paper that I could find in order to remember certain things too. So yeah, my phone is usually my most trusty piece of gadgetry that I pour all of my notes into. So if that ever died on me, I think my career would be over.
yeah, traveling with lots of adapters and chargers.
Yeah, that's
and
all right. That. Yeah.
Yeah, and back on that 2019 World Cup, I'm a big fan of that Matildas jersey. I've got a men's version of that one, and it's one of my favourites. But
yeah,
that was an iconic one. I'm a big fan of football fashion.
Yes, great. So am I. And I with that jersey, originally I didn't love it because I didn't like that it was a throwback to the Socceroos. I thought that because it was the first ever bespoke Matildas jersey, it should stand alone. It shouldn't be referencing men. It shouldn't be derivative. It should just be itself.
Yeah.
But as I started to see the number of men that were buying it because of that connection and therefore starting to establish an emotional connection to the Matildas, I was like, okay, I actually see what this is now, and I understand and appreciate that the Matildas and the Socceroos are part of the same family. They're two sides of the same coin. We don't need to be separated from each other. We can refer to one another and interlink with one another because that actually makes us stronger, diving and tangling up in our own respective histories and learning a lot from that as well. And now, you know, post Women's World Cup in 2023, I mean, how many men and boys do you see walking around in Matildas jerseys, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the great thing for me is that the rise of the Matildas over the past 4 years has not just inspired like a generation or generations of women and girls, but also generations of boys, because ultimately, like, those are the boys who are going to end up as leaders and politicians and coaches and business leaders and, you know, people in really powerful positions who can look back onto a tournament and a moment where they were inspired by women, which is something that I don't think we've really had in a sporting context before in Australia.
Speaking of being inspired by women and moving into the digital journalism role with ABC, I've heard, you know, Karen Tai mentioned, and Tracy Holmes has been the last episode actually of this show she was on, so a great conversation too. And just wondering who, like, inspired you and supported you and provided that mentorship, if you had any, coming through.
Yeah, there are a couple of key women for me over the course of my journey who I am deeply grateful for, some of whom I'm still very, very close with. The first is Anne O'Dong, who is the current media manager for the Matildas. She was the first person who plucked me from Twitter and said, "Hey, I can see that you're yelling about women's football over there. Do you want to come and yell about women's football on my blog?" And I said, "Yes, sure, why not?" So she was the founder of The Women's Game, which was the first women's football focused website in Australia. And Anne was an incredible mentor for me, an incredible friend. She taught me so much about how to write different kinds of stories in football. She taught me how to write match reports. She taught me how to do an interview. She taught me how to write a feature, a piece of analysis, you know, all these sort of genres that I think in sports journalism we kind of take for granted sometimes, that they have their own special skill sets, their own kinds of language, their own kind of deadlines, their own kind of storytelling to them. And coming from academia, like, I was used to writing essays. I was used to citing my sources. I was used to a very different kind of writing. So, pardon me, Anne was incredibly generous in literally sitting down with me sometimes over Zoom for 2 hours of an evening after her full-time job and my full-time study, and us sitting down and going through a story that I'd written sentence by sentence and refining it and trying to figure out how to make it better. So Anne was really important to me, and also Cheryl Downs, who was part of The Women's Game and is now the editor of Beyond 90. She was really important for me. In terms of moving into freelancing, I didn't have any women mentors in a sort of editorial sense at that point, which I think is still one of the big challenges that we face in Australian media more generally, is that a lot of major publications, the higher up you go in the hierarchy of management, the fewer and fewer women, the fewer queer people, the fewer people of colour. There's less diversity in those decision-making positions. And I really felt that when I started to freelance full-time. So I was writing for The Guardian, I was writing for ESPN, SBS, Optus, sometimes ABC as well, a couple of other places. And all of my editors at that point were men. They're all white men as well. And I'm not saying that they weren't excellent, because they were, and I adore them and I'm still friends with all of them, but it was something that I did note in the back of my mind in terms of what were their priorities and how would they appreciate the kinds of perspectives or opinions that I was bringing based on my lived experience and my passions and my community. But over the course of that, like, they were all, of course, mentors to me as well in their own ways. But when I got to the ABC, there were a couple key people who were really important for me in terms of allowing me to kind of understand and appreciate what this big machine of the ABC was. It was my first full-time job in journalism, getting this job at the ABC. So Tracy Holmes was a really, really important person for me when I was starting, not just because she's an absolute legend and has been a trailblazer for women in sport media for such a long time, but she's also incredibly generous with her time. When you go to her asking a question, she will sit down with you and she will go through it. She invited me out for coffees, for lunches. She would check in with me to ask how I'm going. One of the best memories I have is traveling with Tracy through Qatar for the Men's World Cup in 2022. We were two of four ABC journalists who went, and we bunked together in the same apartment. And I was able to really see what it's like to be Tracy Holmes and what it takes to be a legend in this industry. I mean, she would be up until all hours of the morning putting together packages, and then she'd be up at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning going off and doing a live video cross for breakfast television. She was just such a workhorse, and I really admire so much of what she has sacrificed in order to be that, in order to be who she is. So Tracy was a huge mentor for me. Another one is Amanda Shalala, who's currently the deputy editor of the digital sports team. So my boss's boss. Again, a really kind, really generous, thoughtful, clever, and just a really open and supportive person. One of the few women who have been in an editorial position that I've dealt with in my career. And someone whose opinion I really respect, very similar to Tracy. You know, she works so hard and she's got a young family, so I know how difficult that is for her, but she's still able to achieve so much, and she has so many amazing ideas, and she's so positive all the time and is constantly solutions focused, which I really love in people. So yeah, so it's been an up and down sort of journey at the ABC, but having these women around me to support me in that journey has made it a lot easier.
Just rewinding on Anne Odong, I think she's a great West Australian as well.
Sure is, the women's absolutely.
I saw an article about her where she mentioned Penny Tanner-Hoth, who I just wanted to shout out as well, who's a life member of Football West and like a legend of the game here, and been such a trailblazer as well in media. So big shout out if she's listening too.
Yes, absolutely. Shout out to Penny, and because you are the Anne to Anne, Penny. So, you know, I owe you a debt of gratitude as well.
Maybe if I call you a football academic, I don't know if you've been labeled that one, but I really like the creativity of your story. So looking at, for instance, you've done a story about football behind the wall in North Korea for women. You know, the Matildas jersey history in the lead up to the 2022 Men's World Cup, the profiles on the Socceroos players like Aziz Bayich and Jackson Irvine, just getting to know them as a human being. So when they stepped out on the field, it was like you actually knew them. It was like the Matildas documentary, but actually like an article series, you know.
Yeah.
So I just want to know how you sort of pitch these and how you think about these. What's the process behind the scenes to like get a story like this out there to people?
Yeah, so I guess it depends on where you work, I think. For me, I have such a supportive manager, Kyle Pollard, who really trusts me, and he trusts my instincts, and he trusts when I know that I've got a good story or a good idea. So with the North Korea story, for example, it was something that I was always really curious about personally, and that's how I tend to know that it's a good idea to pitch a story like that to my boss, because if I'm curious about it, I think other people will probably be curious about it as well. So the North Korea story, I was so proud of that story. It was something that I'd wanted to do for a long time, but it was so hard to put together because information on that country is so scarce. And information on particular aspects of that country, like its football, is even scarcer. So I really loved the opportunity to, similar to a lot of the history stories I wrote before the Women's World Cup, go back to my research skills as an academic and dive into databases and the internet and really look and research and corroborate and interview and try and find information that I was able to publish in order to tell this amazing story. And I think for the North Korea one, you know, they're such a mysterious country. I think I almost didn't need to kind of jazz it up. I didn't need to do anything, put any bells or whistles on it, because they were already such an intriguing story in themselves. And the little glimpses that we've had of North Korea through sport, I think are one of the few really that the world has got about who these people are and what they're about. So that combined with North Korea's history in women's football in particular, like it was like all my planets were aligning, you know, it was just such a great moment to be able to talk about it in the lead up to that Olympic qualifier against Japan, which they unfortunately lost. But yeah, it was a really great story. I was really thrilled with how that came out. And I was really happy that so many people loved it as well. They really appreciated it and they really learned from it as well. Similar to a lot of stories I've written about a number of other nations over the last couple of years, I remember writing about Taiwan, for example, and the history of the Taiwanese women's national team. I remember writing a story about Tonga, a couple of other like smaller nations that you wouldn't necessarily think about in the context of the women's game, but have these really rich, complex stories that I feel really privileged to tell. But when it comes to the Socceroos stories, again, a series that I was really, really proud of, the thinking behind that for me at that time was that, you know, we were coming into this World Cup, but it really felt like more widely, Australia didn't really know who the Socceroos were. The Matildas, yes, the Matildas were starting to generate a lot more hype, a lot more interest, enthusiasm in the build up to the Women's World Cup. But for the men, you know, really a lot of people were just like, after Mark Viduka, who? Like they didn't really know who the Socceroos were. And so for me, my big driving sort of goal in all of my stories, in all of my career is how do I get people to care about this thing that I care about? How do I get these people to care about the Socceroos that I care about? And I knew some of these players already. I'd followed them for a while at club level. I knew how interesting and how wonderful they were. And I just wanted to try and find a way to use my skills to be able to share that with other people. So I was able to coordinate a number of sort of lengthy interviews with the Socceroos media team, with a number of the players. I think I got to maybe 10. I can't quite remember how many I did, but I wanted to at least get to 11 before the tournament kicked off, but to at least sort of cover off, you know, the starting 11 type of deal, and have an array of different kinds of players as well, sort of veteran players like Aziz, newer players like Aiden Hrustic, players from different multicultural backgrounds, players who are different, have different sort of political experiences or cultural experiences. You know, Jackson Irvine was a really great chat because he's so deeply involved in the politics of football and the culture of football with St. Pauli in Germany. I really loved the opportunity to get to know these guys. And I was really grateful that they were willing to share so much of themselves with me as well. It's a really rare thing to sit down, I think, when you're an athlete with a journalist and be asked questions about those deeper parts of yourself. Like one of the things I've noticed as I've progressed in my career is that, you know, sometimes you tend to get kind of cliche answers from footballers a lot of the time, but that's because you ask a cliche question and they've already got the sort of the rote learned answer in their head. So they don't really need to think about it. But I was coming at these questions and these people from a very different storytelling background. I was drawing upon my literature experience, not my journalism experience. And I wanted to know about what made them tick. I wanted to know about what made them fail, what made them hurt, all these kinds of like human experience moments that is, I think, the core of how you get people to care about each other. Because again, that was my ultimate goal. How do I get Australia to care about these Socceroos who are about to go to Qatar and compete in this incredible World Cup? And so I was so thrilled that I was able to paint these portraits of these men who then went out and created history for Australian football in going as far as they did in Qatar.
You did a, a particular prose or a passage where you talk about Aziz Bajic's run through the Argentinian defense. It's just it's just genius. Like, and then it talks about, you know, imagining and the hope, and it was also a theme later on. But that World Cup was so unique, and it was a really positive sort of aspect, because so much was negative before the World Cup. You know, every tournament sort of has its challenge or its angle that's a little bit of a media sensation. And with this one, it was, you know, that it's in a country with the problems we talked about. But then reading your articles before going, I got to take my mum to the World Cup, and we were reading it and we're like, you know, this is really positive. Really looking forward to actually heading there and seeing what this is about. So, yeah, your cultural and your travel aspect to that writing as well was really special.
Well,
it's not
you.
Even a question, but it's more of a comment.
No. I appreciate it. And I'm actually glad that you mentioned it, because Qatar, yeah, it was a really complicated tournament to cover in that respect. And I think even after I'd got home, I was still really reckoning with what I had experienced and trying to reconcile the incredible highs of being there to witness the Socceroos do this thing, which, you know, going back to, again, 2005 when I was 12 and watching them create history in a World Cup context, and then now I was there in Qatar watching them beat Denmark and seeing them go all the way against that. Like, it was so emotionally charged for me in that way. But it was always couched with this darker context of where we were and the circumstances under which this World Cup was happening and the many, many people who had suffered in order for us to be here and to witness that. So from a journalist's perspective, I was really ethically, I was very challenged when I was there. I didn't quite know what the balance was in terms of does every story that I write need to mention the darkness around us, or can I write some things that are just about the team? They're just about Harry Suter being tall. They're just about, you know, like, they're just these other kind of more lighthearted ones that, you know, we all kind of know that this is happening. We all know that Qatar hosting the World Cup is a problem. We all know the stories of the migrant workers and the treatment of queer people and all this stuff. What's my job in that conversation? And I think, you know, I tried to balance it as best as I could while I was there, you know, focusing on the football itself and the hope and all that kind of stuff you mentioned, while also having some other kinds of pieces around the side, which were about other nations, other political challenges, and trying to sort of gesture towards what else was happening in that moment that was not Socceroos related. And I think probably the piece that encompassed that the best was the story I wrote after the final, after Argentina won. And Messi, you know, had the World Cup, and he was draped in this beautiful sheer black sort of cloak, which is apparently a sign of, it's a symbol of Qatari kind of royalty. But for me, it was sort of such a metaphor for the kind of shadow that will always linger over that moment and that tournament and that win for him and for Argentina. Yeah, it was really challenging. I think even now, looking back and flicking back through photos of being in Qatar, I still haven't quite wrapped my head around it. I think it was a very surreal, bizarre kind of experience, because it felt very much like a performance. It felt like Qatar was putting on this grand show for all of us tourists who were going over there to watch the tournament. That's because that's exactly what they were doing. And it's almost like I was gaslighting myself sometimes, because I was like, is this real? Is this actually like what Qatar is like, or is this just on stage for us because the eyes of the world are upon this country in this particular moment? So yeah, it was a very weird time in my life.
Yeah, and with some friends, we also reflect on the Russia World Cup 2018, you know, because that was a fantastic tournament by itself in terms of the organization. And then to see, you know, what's happened now, it doesn't need to be explained, but just with time. And then we almost didn't get much time to even digest that, because we went 6 months into, you know, our own World Cup. that we're hosting on our shores. And how was that for you, preparing and mobilizing for what was going to be the biggest tournament for all of us, and especially your career?
Yeah, it really was. It really was. It's funny, I did an interview recently with an honors student who was wanting to talk to me because a couple of months after the World Cup ended, I tweeted about how I was really struggling to come to terms with it, and my mental health was not in a great place, and the come down post-World Cup was so significant for me that I was feeling really lost. And so I've been reflecting back on all these kinds of feelings and the whole experience of the tournament recently because of this interview that I'd done. And yeah, I think I look back on that month and really the sort of the 3 or 4 months that preceded it, as well as probably the 2.5 years that preceded that, all the way back to the night that we won the bid. I look back on that moment with such pride and such clarity, because that, I think, was the first time in my professional life that I was absolutely certain about what I was doing. I had a crystal clear goal. I knew exactly the kind of work that I wanted to produce, and everything that I did, every decision that I'd made, everything was gravitating around this one key tournament, this home World Cup. And it was really interesting to kind of see myself running almost in parallel with the growing hype of this tournament as well. Like, my career sort of started to take off at the same time that we'd won the bid. And so my sort of steps up into the bigger sort of football media landscape, I suppose, was running in tandem with our preparations for this tournament. And I think because of that, I tied so much of myself to what I was doing, and so much of who I was and my community and my sense of purpose in my job to this 1 month-long event. And I think there were positives and negatives to that. Looking back on it, I think the biggest positive is that I think I produced probably the best work of my life before and during the World Cup. I was really adamant when I was told by my manager that he effectively wanted me to lead the digital coverage that we had at the ABC and to come up with a bit of a coverage plan for it. I was really passionate about two particular pillars that I wanted to nail down. The first was history, and wanting to use the opportunity and the platform and the spotlight of the Women's World Cup to teach people about the very long history of women's football in Australia, stretching all the way back to 100 years ago, nailing down all those big key moments, the pilot Women's World Cup the Matildas took part in China, the fastest ever red card that was earned by a Matilda, the history of the jerseys, the history of St. George Budapest, the first sort of women's team to become the core of the first Matilda side, like all of these stories about all these pioneer women who hadn't really had an opportunity to be celebrated. I was really, really passionate about telling those stories and making sure that these women were public knowledge, that people knew who they were and really appreciated the work that they had done in order to get not just the Matildas, but the entire women's game to the point where we were hosting a home World Cup. So I had a big list of about 20 stories that I was wanting to research and write before the tournament kicked off. And I think I finished my final one maybe the day before the tournament started. So I was really thrilled about that. So that was my first pillar, was history. And my second pillar was the coverage that I wanted to do during the tournament itself. I think based on my learnings from Qatar and the things that I wish that I had done when I was there, I promised myself that I wanted to try and capture how this tournament felt to people, because I knew that so much of our mainstream media would be covering it in terms of match reports and analysis pieces and interviews with players and all the kind of the stuff that you usually see with a big tournament. But I really believed that I had a particular set of storytelling skills that I wanted to used to my advantage, and I wanted to try and make the work that I made different. I wanted to make it memorable, and I wanted to be able to look back on the work that I produced and almost feel like I'd captured something in the bottle of my language, that we could read back these stories and be like, gosh, remember how that was? Remember that moment? Remember how that felt? Rather than, you know, sort of a match report or this happened and this happened and this happened, I wanted to capture how this thing felt. And I think I did that. I was really, really proud of a lot of the stories that I wrote during that tournament. But I think the three that really stand out to me that I wouldn't change, I think were probably, they ticked every single box that I had hoped for, were the Canada game, the France game, and the England game.
Yeah. They're the ones in my notes too.
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah, great. I mean, because they were just like to be there and to experience them and to experience those stadiums and to experience those games with the kind of stakes that were there, with how passionate these players were, with everything that we'd known about them, with the sort of bigger context of Sam Kerr, with all this stuff, all these layers of knowledge and feeling and community. I really wanted to try and harness all of that and to use all the skills that I'd learned over 10 years of studying literature to try and tell a story that was able to reach people and that was able to move people and that people would walk away from being like, wow, I don't think I'll ever read something like that ever again. So those are the three stories that I think I'm most proud of the whole tournament.
Let's go with the France game, because that is the France game. It's always exactly. It's in the dictionary as a France game. and that article, I read it the other day just to go back, and it was like, it gave me goosebumps again, just took you into that moment, you know. And I was personally at Stadium Australia working with the FIFA team on the Colombia-England game.
Oh,
and we were getting ready for, all the volunteers were getting ready to walk out, but no one wanted to go out because they're watching the penalty shootout. So that game, you know, the fans only came in with a few minutes to go. I think the stadium has never seen so many fans go in that time, in that small amount of time. And our experience was pretty interesting. But what was it like for you waking up that day? What do you recall from the France game day?
What do I recall from the France game day? Wow. It was all a bit of a blur. I remember waking up in my crappy little hotel in Brisbane and having to do a podcast episode, I think, with the Far Post gals, which is something, again, a legacy of 2019 is that podcast. I remember, I think, working on another story from another game. I can't quite remember what it was. But then I remember there was a live site that was next to the river in Brisbane, and I hadn't been there yet. So I went over, I walked from my hotel over to the live site, and there were people everywhere wearing Matilda's jerseys, and there was a group of Matilda's alumni who had gathered near one of the the stages that had been set up in this live site, and they were all brought up one by one and introduced by the host, and there was sort of a crowd of people there who were applauding them. You know, women who were just like everyday women. You'd walk past them in the street, you wouldn't know who they were, but all of a sudden they're here, and you know that they're a Matilda, and that's such a special thing. And then I remember walking to the stadium in the afternoon. I always like walking to the stadium in Brisbane because it's a very walkable city, and if I ever get the opportunity to, I always prefer to walk to a stadium than to catch public transport or to drive or anything like that, because you get to overhear conversations, you get to see families, you get to see what people are wearing, how people are feeling, and you get to kind of absorb all of that. I remember it was a really beautiful, clear day. Near my hotel was a church as well, and I remember walking past this church and just giving a little bit of a bit of a nod, like, come on, you know. And there was a group of closer to the stadium, there was a group of people handing out Bibles as well, and I remember walking past and saying, Can you just throw up a prayer for the Matildas tonight, please, folks? And they're like, yep, of course, go Tillys. So I was like, yes, great. So maybe that's the reason we won. I don't know. But, yeah, so I the closer you got to the stadium, the more and more the sidewalks were filling up with people. And I don't know if you've ever been to Brisbane Stadium, but Lang Park, but you walk up sort of a set of stairs and you go over sort of a concourse from the main street, and you sort of spill out into this big intersection where there's like a pub, there are bars everywhere, there's restaurants, there's shops, and everything was just Matildas. It was green and gold everywhere. I hadn't seen so many people wearing Matildas stuff before in my life. I went to the pub where the Matildas active fans were, and went and saw a bunch of my friends who I've known for years and years, and had a beer and said some prayers and some pre-match predictions and gave everyone a hug, and then walked off and did a lap of the stadium again to kind of soak in all the vibes and all the energy and all the excitement and to see how people were sort of getting ready for this moment. But I think like none of us expected what we saw, you know. It still strikes me thinking back to it that I don't even know how I was able to write about it. I don't even know how I was able to produce that story by the next day, because it was so overwhelming and so much happened. You know, it felt like it was two games. It was the game, and then it was the penalty shootout, which was its own thing. And the penalty shootout had all these different stories wrapped up in it as well. Mackenzie Arnold had the missed penalty. He had the retaken penalty. He had players who you think would hit their penalties, they got saved, and it was just this whole incredible thing. I was sitting next to, during the game, I was sitting next to my colleague John Healy, who was doing the live blog for the ABC while I was doing the analysis. And we were sort of watching the ticker on the ABC blog in terms of the number of people who were watching just climb up and up and up and up the longer that the game went on. And in our sort of post-tournament review, we learned that live blog was actually the highest read story across the entire ABC for the whole year, which is kind of extraordinary. And it speaks to like how much of our country was genuinely part of this one moment together. Like, we saw all the videos of the live sites and people on planes and, you know, all the kind of stuff of people watching the game. But like, I feel like we don't even now, we can't fully appreciate the fact that really, it wasn't since maybe 2005, that Socceroos game against Uruguay, that it felt like genuinely the whole country was watching this one moment. And when, like, you try to be professional in moments like this. Like, when I was in Qatar, I remember having a conversation with Tracy, and she told me, you know, I know that you love the Socceroos. I know that you're very emotionally attached to football, but to do your job, you need to separate your emotions from the work.
That's hard.
It's impossible for me. I can't do it. And this France game was probably the epitome of that, because I couldn't sit down for the whole penalty shootout. I was too nervous. I think if I sat down, I would have probably thrown up. So I was on my feet, constantly moving around, turning to people, yelling, like just trying to just ride the roller coaster of emotions that we were all going through. And it got to Courtney Vine, and I was like, oh my God, if Courtney Vine scores this goal, like it could be history. It could be the most extraordinary moment of my life. And you know, I'd watched Courtney Vine for years. I'd watched her when she played in the MPLW. I'd watched her wheel a wheelie bin with flags around Valentine Sports Park when she was still partially unemployed. You know, I watched this player go from strength to strength in the A-League Women's. I watched her get her Matildas debut, and now she was here stepping up to what could be a winning penalty in this game against France to get the Matildas through to the Final Four. And I had to get my phone out, because I trust my brain and my memory, but I need to record this, because this could be one of the most important moments that I ever experience. And it's probably a stupid thing that I did record it, because as soon as she scored it, I screamed so loudly that I think I broke my phone, and the image just like goes wildly away, like because I threw my phone somewhere. Like it didn't even capture the thing that I was meant to capture. What it did was it captured the emotion of it, which I think was probably the most important thing. So yeah, it was just the noise that came from that stadium when she scored that penalty is unlike anything I'd ever heard. I was genuinely like, I burst into tears. I could feel the ground shaking beneath me. It really did feel like the whole of Australia was celebrating that moment.
What do you even say after that? It's not possible to follow up. But how did you follow up, actually? What do you even do after that? Do you go out, have a few beers, or are you going straight into the story and to capture what you've actually just seen?
Yeah, look, everyone's different. It depends it depends on what you need to do on the night. So depending on which publication you worked for, depending on what your particular responsibility was. John, for example, was absolutely steely-faced. He had no emotion on him whatsoever because he was working. He was blogging. He had to capture this for our live blogging audience, which was over 1 million people. So he was really locked in and in the flow of that moment. I was losing my mind. A couple of other people in the Australia media section were losing their minds as well. Other people were, you know, shoulders hunched over their laptops, writing furiously to get an on-the-whistle match report done. And in the sort of the hours following, you know, we went down to the media conferences down at the basement of the stadium, and then did the player interviews. They come past in a bit of a line with some fencing, and so obviously all of them stopped because they were like, oh my god, this is the most amazing thing. So we just talked to all these players and captured all their emotion, and that was fabulous. So that probably that sort of post game media kind of content gathering stuff sort of goes for maybe about an hour or two. And then depending on if you've already filed your story, if you've got other things to do, you kind of gravitate towards a bunch of people who, if you're all done at the same time, you all go to the pub. And a lot of us went back to the pub just for just one celebration beer, just something to be able to sit and decompress a little bit as well. Like, what the hell did we just experience? How do we make sense of this thing? How are we feeling about what happens next? And just like, it's literally just sitting around with a group of friends pretty much and talking about what we just went through. But for me, I had to work, and I knew, weirdly, I knew exactly what I was going to say. I went back to my hotel room at probably 11:30, maybe midnight. And I think I wrote the story of the France game in about 4 hours, and then I went to sleep, and I woke up at, I think it was 7 a.m. the next morning to do another podcast episode. So that was the routine of it, really, for Matilda's match days, was staying up very, very late into the very early hours of the next morning. Then having to get up again to keep it going all the way until the end.
So you'd put it in your laptop, send it through to your editor, and then would it be basically up the next morning? Yep.
Yep, pretty much. Yep. So in addition to writing the actual story, one of the other things that we do at the ABC is usually we get taught how to build the story as well in the CMS system, which is basically like the back end of the website. That's a great thing to be able to do, because it means that, you know, while you have produced your text, it also means that you can choose your own photos, you can choose your own headlines, you can choose your own little pieces of teaser text that go out on social media, things like that. So yeah, you can really craft the story and shape it with imagery and language that is exactly to your liking, which is what I really loved.
Now, moving to Stadium Australia. So some of our team, when we realised that Matildas had just won this penalty shootout, it became a realisation that we were going to be able to work on the Matildas match against England in the semi-final. And that was like very emotional. That was really exciting. That was like another layer on top, wasn't it, in terms of just the gravity of the occasion, the build-up, the hype, and we saw the metrics afterwards. But your description of Sam Kerr's goal was epic. It was almost as good as the goal itself, you know. Like, you know, you're talking about how she receives it deep in her heart, and then the wording is majestic. So how do you actually recall a moment like that? Is it watching the replays, or is it just you've seen it once and then you just describe it?
It's both. Yeah, it's both. Yeah. It's like every rider is different, and I think when it comes to this story for me, the thing that was really driving my anger with it, I suppose, was the mixture of pride and melancholy that I felt afterwards, and that all the players felt afterwards. I really wanted to, because it kind of felt like the end, that game, didn't it? Like, even though we had that game against Sweden for the third place playoff, the England loss really did feel like the end of the tournament. And so I wanted to try and write a piece that captured not just the feeling of disappointment that we had, but how thrilling it was that we got there in the first place. And sometimes as a writer, you really have to work at a story. You really have to chip away at something and write a number of drafts to get to the thing that you're trying to say. But other times it comes to you like that. And this was the story that it came to me like lightning. And it was the run. It was the run that Sam Kerr had made, and the parallel with the run that the Matildas had made through the tournament, and the other parallel with the run that Cathy Freeman had made in that same stadium in 2000. And it all just aligned so perfectly and so instantly for me that I was like, this is exactly the image that I need, is this run that she does. And I was so relieved that she scored that goal. Like, the goal itself was spectacular, but I was so happy that she just had that moment, because this World Cup really was Sam Kerr's World Cup. You know, she was the face of it. She was the captain of the Matildas. She was in all the marketing material. She was in such ripping form up until she got that injury. And she'd had to sit on the sidelines and watch the Matildas do this thing without her. And so I was just really overjoyed for her to have a moment like that where, you know, finally she got to do the thing that she had been wanting and dreaming and hoping to do in this tournament, in a game like this as well, against England, you know. And once she'd scored it, you know, it was 1-1, and it felt like for a moment it felt like there was hope. For a moment, you know, it felt like maybe we could actually do it. But you know, it wasn't to be. And I actually think, looking back, that I'm weirdly grateful that that's how it ended. I think if we had reached the final, we were so gassed already. The team was so tired already that Spain would have just run rings around us. And I don't think that would have been a very pleasant experience for anyone. But I think what the England game showed was that, you know, we had this heart and we had this spirit, and I say we as though I was on the field, but it felt like it, right? It felt like we were all there on that field with them, tearing ourselves across the grass, trying to will this team to win, because we loved them so much and we saw so much of ourselves in them and the way that they navigated this tumultuous tournament. I'm really glad that it ended with that kind of message, I suppose, that this team is capable of doing this incredible thing by being together and trusting themselves and playing to who they are and always wanting and using the platforms that they have to try and make the game better and bigger for whoever comes after them. It was a lot of kind of my own seven stages of grieving, I think, that I kind of had to process in the course of that story. But I was so proud of it. I was so proud of Sam for being able to stand up and do what she did in a moment like that. I was so proud of the team. And I was so proud of us. I was so proud of the country for being able to get around them in the way that we did. It was something that people who've been in women's football for a really long time imagined could happen, but I don't think we ever thought that it would happen quite as soon as what it did. And so there was a kind of magical element to all of that, which made it really hard to be sad about anything that happened.
Yeah, but still a big thank you, because, you know, that was really deflating loss for everyone. And just to read something from you, and also Craig Foster wrote a very good article that was really around the themes of hope and that the celebration of the run, the journey, and looking forward. Really needed to read something like that. That was important, because yeah, it was very devastating, especially to lose to England.
I know. It was really, I know, it was challenging, wasn't it? And in a kind of traditional sporting lens, it was really shitty to lose to England, because we, you know, we have these rivalries and all these other kinds of sports. But I remember actually writing a story that previewed that game, which tapped into that kind of bigger question about rivalries. And I think I can't exactly remember the wording of the title, but it was something along the lines of the Matildas are their own myth makers. Like, when we're not folding, this team doesn't fold into the bigger myths that have been written about England versus Australia by other teams or other sports, mostly men as well. This is a story that they're writing for themselves. This is a rivalry that they're writing for themselves. And I think that semi-final did that. You know, it is going to be a rivalry, but it's their rivalry now. It's not something that's borrowed from someone else.
Now, looking post-World Cup, you mentioned it's difficult to decompress afterwards. How was that time for you? What helped you, straight after a World Cup like that, in the whirlwind of it?
Yeah, it was really, really challenging. I took a lot of lessons, actually, from my experience at Qatar. When I got back from Qatar, I was absolutely exhausted physically. I was so tired. And the week that I got home, I actually got very sick. Similar to sort of like when you go away for a holiday and you're having so much fun and you're on adrenaline all the time, and you come back and relax, and all of a sudden your immune system lets all the viruses in. So I got very sick after Qatar, and it took me a good probably 2 months to kind of get back to the level that I was before I'd left. Sorry, I'm currently sick at the moment as well. And so based on that learning, I planned ahead, and I said to my boss, look, I'm going to be working pretty much nonstop for this entire tournament. And in the months leading up to it, I'm doing all this work as well. So I want to have at least a month off after it's over to just give myself the space and the time to decompress and to process and to almost grieve. To go through the emotions of losing something that you had worked so hard for and that had been such a core part of your everyday life for so long. It felt like losing a person when the World Cup was over for me, because it was literally the thing that guided all of my decisions. It was my North Star. So I had a month off. I slept a lot. I went on holidays. I didn't really watch very much football. I just tried to kind of re-engage in the world. But unfortunately, the brain works very differently. It doesn't work according to a schedule of of decompression as much as I hoped it would. So it took me a lot longer, actually, to process it. I think probably it's only really in the last maybe 2 months that I think I've kind of re-emerged from the come down of the World Cup. And going back to what I said before about how I poured so much of myself into that tournament, I think this was the bad part of it. The good part of it was that I was able to produce some of that that work that I'm so proud of. But the bad part of it is that I came off the back of this thing feeling incredibly lost, feeling very isolated, very lonely, and not really knowing what my next goal was, not really knowing what my next North Star was going to be. Because this had been everything, and I really hadn't been able to see past it. I hadn't been able to plan past it. And I think that was, it was to my detriment, I guess, in that respect. Even though I think my work will outlast me, and hopefully it will do all the things that I hope that it will in terms of capturing that moment and being a reference point for a sort of a cultural experience. But yeah, I really did struggle after it was over. I had to see a psychologist in order to try and work through it. And even now I'm still trying to figure out, I suppose, what the next chapter of my own journey looks like. You know, my career had really taken off over the last 3 years in the build up to the World Cup. And now I'm kind of at this level that I never really imagined that I would be. And so it's really hard to imagine what's next, because you're still sort of looking around being like, how the hell did I get here? Yeah. So it's a constant, daily kind of challenge for me to figure out what the next thing is. But I'm in a much better place now where I've got a lot of support around me. I have more hobbies, which is not just watching more football. So yeah, hot tip to any aspiring sports journalists out there, get another hobby that's not sport. Don't just define yourself by your work, because when that work is over, yeah, you tend to go with it. So yeah, I'm still trying to figure out what the next thing is, but I'm more excited by the possibilities than I am afraid of them now.
What are your hobbies?
My hobbies at the moment are baking. Love baking. My hobbies are trying to minimalize my house as well. I tend to accumulate a lot of stuff. So I'm going through the process of like spring or winter cleaning, I suppose it can be called now, going through all my old things and sort of, yeah, like going through a bit of a, it's almost like a meditative process of cleansing and removing old things and old memories and trying to start anew. So there's that. And also there's weightlifting, which is something that I'm starting to get into as well. So yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. Which moves in particular? Like upper body?
I love a deadlift. Yeah. I love lower legs. Deadlifting is my jam.
Nice. Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, the baking helps because that fuels you. And then,
that's right.
Yeah. You're creating more space in the apartment to do deadlifts or the house or wherever
you
live.
It's all part of the plan.
Yeah. Nice. One thing you mentioned as looking at, you know, beyond your work is that Our Game women and non-binary persons in media program and the mentoring you're now doing. Yeah. Talk us through your approach to that and how that's been in your career as well.
Yeah, I was so thrilled when I was asked by Anne O'Dong, actually, who's sort of the brain behind this program, to be the first mentor for one of the streams. Her and I, we'd talked over the years about how much we wished we had had some kind of a formal mentorship program that was available to us when we were first starting out, in the same way that Anne was the mentor for me. Like, how can we basically formalize that and make that more of a serious thing, with opening more opportunities, more doors for people, networking, teaching them writing skills, connecting them with resources, things like that, rather than us just sort of ad hocing and bumping into each other on Twitter. So the first intake of that program was, it started just before the World Cup. There were two streams. One was a photography stream, which was, the mentor was, another very good friend of ours, a guy named Joe. And I was the mentor for the media and communications stream, I suppose it is. So I had five little minions who were part of my stream, and some of them have now spun off into their own careers in sport media, which is such a thrill to see. And for me, I suppose when it came to mentoring or being a leader, I tried to be the kind of mentor that I wanted to have. I tried to be the mentor that Anne was to me. I tried to be a mentor that I've had in other kind of professional spaces of my life as well. Someone who is very generous, someone who is very conscious of where a person is and not sort of pushing them too far outside of what they are comfortable doing. Someone who can provide serious feedback if it's wanted, or who can just gently guide or gesture towards or suggest different things if that's what's wanted as well. But really just being a sounding board, I think, for these folks who are at a stage in their careers where the biggest challenge for them is trusting themselves, is trusting their instincts and trusting that the thing that they're interested in is something that other people will be interested in as well. So that's how I sort of approached it. And I had different sort of relationships with all of them and was able to sort of gently move them in different kinds of directions that I thought that they would be really great at. I really loved it. I appreciated the opportunity to do that. I learned a lot about myself as well as a mentor in that space. And so if I ever get the opportunity to do it again, I think that there are some things that I would do probably a little bit differently. And it probably didn't help as well that the first intake of the program happened like parallel with the World Cup. So yeah. I was basically like not a mentor to them for that whole, like that whole tournament period, unfortunately. But, I don't know, hopefully they won't hold it against me.
Another one is, Samantha, with your knowledge and love of football, if there was one rule you would change in the game, what would it be?
Oh, one rule that I would change. Look, one of the things that really drives me mad is goalkeepers taking so much time to clear the ball. Like, I think that really needs to be punished more. In the Matildas' recent game against Mexico, there was a moment right towards the end of the game where the goalkeeper held the ball for probably like 10 seconds. No. It was for like, I didn't time it, but it felt like a long time. And like time wasting in general, just really, it's just very annoying. And I think about it as well from the perspective of like, how much football do we actually see in a game? You know what I mean? I think there was a study that was done a couple of years ago, which genuinely like it timed the amount of football that was being played in the course of 90 minutes. And like, aside from all the stoppages and fouls and pauses and throw-ins and all that kind of stuff. And I think that they found that there was really only 60 minutes of football that gets played and the rest of it is just time wasting. I hate time wasting. It's so annoying. In terms of other rules, gosh, I don't know, you know? Like, I think football's pretty perfect in terms of its rules. I don't think it really anything needs to change. The only thing that I would absolutely remove is VAR, probably, because it's such a fundamental disruption to the joy of a moment. And I'm all about the joy of a moment, you know? So having a bloody piece of technology come and ruin it, nah, not about it. So get rid of VAR, I think that's my answer.
Yeah, it hasn't really removed the controversy of a call. And also, no. I'm all for backing the referee, you know, back the human, because the players make errors. The referee might make an error. That's okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. The spontaneity of a goal celebration is so beautiful, you know, and to take that away and have that second guessing.
Can you imagine if Courtney Vine's penalty had been called back through VAR?
No, please don't talk like that.
Don't. You know what I mean? Yeah. It completely ruins the entire experience.
Well, Samantha, there's been no time wasting on this one. More than 60 minutes of football in this podcast, and I'm mindful of your time. Just wanted to ask if there's any. You know, any message to leave the listener with, anywhere that they can find you on and all the different platforms as well?
If you want to hear me yell more about football, you can follow me at Battle Dinosaur on Twitter, which I know is an unfortunate Twitter handle, but I got it when I was like 16 and now I'm too far gone to change it. So I kind of have to stick with it.
I was going
to
ask you that actually, yeah.
I actually have a tattoo of a dinosaur on my body because of that Twitter handle, funnily enough.
It's not the Twitter handle, it's just a dinosaur?
It's just a dinosaur, yeah. Thankfully. It's not the actual Twitter handle. I'm not that much of a nerd. But the message that I would leave people with is, it depends on who you are, but, you know, keep showing up. Australian football, I think we go through ebbs and flows of things, and particularly after a major tournament, there is a real come down, and there's always a slamming back to the reality of the domestic game here. And that's for a number of different reasons, and a lot of people are very cynical and very apathetic about how we move forward as a sport. And, you know, even I have had moments post-World Cup where I have been really doubtful that we're actually capable of being this incredible sport that I think a lot of us believe that we're capable of being. But we have to keep showing up. We have to keep being there. We have to keep helping. We have to keep pushing it in the direction that we think it needs to go in, because as the World Cup showed us, and as all of these tournaments have shown us, and as every Sunday morning, 9 a.m. kickoff in freezing Campbelltown has showed us, this sport is special, and it brings people together in ways that I don't think very many other things can do. And that is always going to be worth showing up for.
Thank you for showing up too, Samantha. And one question I couldn't not ask you because of your background in English literature and writing is, you know, what are some of your favorite books or ones that have inspired you, journalists, you can even throw out there, but definitely books. I'm really interested in that one.
Oh, wow. One of my favorite writers is a woman named Catherine Mansfield. Not a lot of people would probably know who she is. She was a contemporary of Virginia Woolf, who is also one of my favorite writers. She was actually from New Zealand. I wrote my master's thesis on her short stories. And the reason why I love her and why I love Woolf and why I love a lot of poets from the sort of modernist period, sort of 1920s to 1940s, is that they were able to capture how it felt to be human. They were able to write in these incredibly poetic ways about consciousness, about feeling, about perception, about how we move through the world, about how we have relationships. They use language in these really unique and really memorable ways. And so I've always really loved that period of writing, particularly English and American modernism. And so reading some of those stories from Mansfield at the Bay is my favorite, but her most famous story is The Garden Party. In terms of Virginia Woolf, To the Lighthouse is my favorite novel, but Mrs. Dalloway is also a really great example of that kind of stream of consciousness kind of writing, which I try to embody sometimes when I work. And in terms of poets as well, I mean, I couldn't even list the poets who I've studied over the years who have inspired me. I think really, funnily enough, one of the ones that sticks out is a poem called Howl by Allen Ginsberg. Again, real stream of consciousness, very politically charged, very sexually charged. These are just examples of language being used that really hit something in you and that leave some kind of indelible mark on your memory and on the way that you think about yourself and the world. I would encourage anyone who's listening to this, if you want to be a journalist, go and read fiction and go and read poetry, because that is the best kind of storytelling.
And go and read Samantha Lewis's fantastic football writing. Thank you so much for your time, Samantha, and I look forward to getting a drink on some concourse at some stadium sometime in the journey. Really appreciate it, and for what you've done for the game and continue to do. So good luck with your deadlifts and your baking and your and your minimalizing. A very big thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And there we have it. That was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for listening. As a community-cultivated, independent podcast, your support means the world, so we can keep these important conversations flowing, taking Wally Love to the world and the world to Wally Love. Until next time, keep smiling, keep scoring.